Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
It's going to sound strange, but I'm having somebody else's dream.
Hello and welcome to a very special spooky episode of Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson, and joining me today is
Anthony Bresnikan, a correspondent from Los Angeles for Vanity Fair.
some schmo we got out in LA is here to talk to me. We're doing a special one-off episode of Still Watching. Richard Lawson and I are still in the midst of our discussion of We Are Who We Are, but Anthony and I thought we would hop on the mics together and talk to you about The Haunting of Bly Manor, which is on Netflix right the heck now. So this is a follow-up of sorts, like sort of an anthologized follow-up to The Haunting of Hill House, which came out on Netflix 2 years ago now, Anthony?
Yeah, 2018.
Right. Yeah, so the mastermind, sort of, you know, the Ryan Murphy of this American Horror Story-esque anthology is one Mike Flanagan, who Anthony and I are huge fans of. We love Mike Flanagan. We love his work. He's done a lot of work adapting Stephen King specifically, but just horror in generally, in general. There's Dr. Sleep. There's, what is it,
Oculus,
Gerald's Game. Yes. What's the one with his wife, Hush?
Hush. Yeah, with Kate Siegel. Kate, his wife is in a lot of his stuff. And, you know, they made the non-supernatural story Hush, which is about a deaf woman who's got a stalker outside her house. So
that one's really interesting. I went on a tear after I watched Haunting of Hill House, because I just loved it so much, and tried to, like, I had already seen Oculus, but I tried to watch everything else sort of in his back catalog, and I felt the experience was very rewarding. So if you want to get your fill of Mike Flanagan, a lot of that stuff is available streaming, so you can check it out.
He's a very Halloween-y director.
And
I mean that in a good way. Like, you know, once October hits, everybody wants, like, that spooky story. And he's not a violent, gruesome kind of horror storyteller. He really does lean into, like, the spiritualism and the eeriness and the mysteries of the past. It's just like exactly what I want every October. So I like that he's on a regular tear with these things. He also made a really good movie that you wouldn't expect to be good. Ouija: Origin of Evil. It was like the sequel to one of those.
Oh, is that good? I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Like, it's very Mike Flanagan. Like, it's not trash. I mean, it's about, like, a Ouija board that summons an evil out of this weird house. But, like, in terms of, like, a ghost story, it's pretty good. It's very dark, actually. And, it's not a bad watch.
So
we need to tell the listeners there'll be hidden ghosts throughout the podcast, and one just went by, but you won't be able to see them because it's audio.
So what they're doing with this, like, haunting series on Netflix appears to be drawing inspiration from famous stories of haunting. The Haunting of Hill House is a loose adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House, and this is an loose adaptation of Henry James's Turn of the Screw, with a couple other Henry James stories sort of sprinkled in there for good measure. We should emphasize loose adaptation, but loose adaptations are often more interesting to me than sort of slavish by the book adaptations. So
I have to say, I was surprised though watching Bly Manor how much fidelity there is to the Turn of the Screw. You know,
yeah,
it's expanded upon clearly. There are moments where, like, you know, where she sees a vision on a parapet at the house while she's out in the yard, and like that's straight from the book. When she sees him through the window, all of that is right. straight from the book, and a lot of it matches.
So let's like premise this a little bit. I guess since we're dropping this episode after all the episodes are available on Netflix, we're definitely going to get into a discussion of the full show, but let's do like a little section right here at the beginning in case folks haven't watched it, where we don't talk about anything that happens towards the end and we just sort of like premise it and maybe give some like vague recommendations. Then you guys can press pause on the podcast, go mainline several episodes of television, and then come back and listen to the end. But
so we'll go spoiler free for a little bit right now.
That's my long-winded way of saying that. Basically, the way that this is considered an anthology is that it's like the Haunting of Hill House, the Haunting of Bly Manor, right? And then we've got a few cast members who are here again. We've got Henry Thomas, we've got Victoria Pedretti, Katie Siegel, as you said, is in the show. We can't talk yet about what her role is. Is that it? Oh, and Carla Gugino.
No, there are a couple. There are a couple others. Did you mention Henry Thomas already?
I did.
You mentioned Henry Thomas, but Oliver Jackson Cohen, who played little brother, the drug addict,
yes.
little brother in
He's
Hill
House.
He's
got a big role in this one.
Yeah, he turns up as one of the sort of menacing presences in the house. I don't think that's a spoiler to say.
No, that's right. That's pretty early on. That's fine.
he's the guy who turns up on the pair. Like, she just, it's just this, but also he's not like, he's not some like grim-faced specter. Like he just looks like a guy. So she's not sure whether she's seeing an intruder or whether she's seeing a ghost, whether she's seeing, you know, whether she's crazy and just imagining things.
Well, that's and that's the beauty of Turn of the Screw, right? Turn of the Screw, which is a story of like a governess who goes to take care of two children at the behest of their uncle at this like spooky manor, and a whole bunch of stuff goes on, and she's not sure whether it's real or whether it's in her head. It's considered sort of similar to Jane Eyre to be like a very extremely psychological story of a governess.
Yeah.
I don't know what expertise Henry James has on female psychology, but you know, it's still an incredibly effective, like, are there or aren't there ghosts here? What, and the sort of romantic / sexual nature of these ghosts lends the whole thing like an extra charge of like forbidden, what have you. So,
forbidden, what have you. Yeah.
What have you, you know.
But it's also a little bit of a precursor to Gaslight, which is a term that is very popular now. I believe that was a play. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Before it was a movie. But it was, you know, the term gaslighting refers to somebody who's telling you that something you objectively observe is not happening. That gaslight isn't flickering. What are you talking about? And in Turn of the Screw, what was really innovative about it was the governess starts to suspect that the kids she's trying to protect from this presence she perceives are actually in on it, or maybe they're the ones causing it, or somehow provoking this, or misleading her. Like, she might, you know, these kids might be playing her, and she. The idea of like evil children was very unusual in 1898 when this story was first published. So they're not, you know, not necessarily evil. She's just not sure about them. And that adds a nice little layer to it, to all of the Freudian psychobabble that also is going on beneath the surface.
Did you ever see The Others, the 2001 film with Nicole Kidman?
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite like loose adaptations of Turn of the Screw. Mm-hmm. And then there's also I saw a stage play of Turn of the Screw when I was really sort of soft and impressionable and young. And it was a two-person play. And the woman played the governess, and then the man played every other role. And it's the scariest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. It was so unsettling.
Oh, I could see how that would work. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, he played all the kids and all, and it was just like, oh, it was awful. So, you know, and really works effectively with this idea of like how much of this is in my head and how much is not and stuff like that. So here we are. We're turning that screw with Henry James. So this is it's set in the '80s, right?
In the year of our Lord, 1987.
So nice '80s period piece. And Victoria Pedretti plays the governess who comes to this manor at the behest of Henry Thomas, the absentee uncle, to take care of these two kids. I want to say, these kids are extraordinary. The actors that they got to play the charges are incredible. And I'm a little mixed on the series as a whole, but like, so it's Benjamin Evan Ainsworth and Amelia B. Smith. But like, it would be so easy for these kids to be cloying or for them to be like over the top in some of the creepiest stuff or whatever. But they're just really rooted in something that feels very true, very actually childlike. And I would say Benjamin Evan Ainsworth, especially, who has like a pretty heavy lift he has to do on something, does an incredible job. So
yeah, a very hard line to walk, especially for a kid actor, because you know, there are times where the kids have to behave in an unusual way. Sometimes I don't think this is a spoiler. Sometimes they seem like they're not kids. And so to sometimes be very childlike and be very innocent and likable, as opposed to, you know, sometimes you cast a mean looking little boy to play Joffrey or to play to play Malfoy or to play Damian in The Omen. And like, yeah, they just, there's something about them that has like a, you know, sinister look about them, but then they're very sweet people in real life. And these kids, you know, they're not just, they don't have a look that goes one way. They sometimes are very appealing and very sweet and you want to protect them. And other times you're like, no.
Exactly.
which as somebody with two children, I will say, is often the case. It strikes true to life.
So there are some, some hidden ghosts, some not so hidden ghosts around. That's part and parcel with haunting. Then there's also some staff to sort of flesh out the cast. So there's Raoul Coley, who I love from iZombie and just want like nothing but the best for him. He plays the chef or the cook, Owen. And
wait, before we go any further, we do have to mention his extraordinary Omar Sharif mustache.
Oh, like, God.
Boy, he has the most luxurious mustache I've ever seen. Like, it makes Tom Selleck look like David Niven.
it's funny, yeah, because on iZombie, he had a full beard, and it's the most beautiful, luxurious beard you've ever seen. And I was once in an elevator with that beard at the Television Critics Association. Like, we're all stuck together in a hotel, and I got in an elevator, and I was like, oh my God, Raoul Coley's beard is in this elevator with me. Oh my God. I didn't say anything. I just sort of like looked straight forward, tried not to make eye contact with the beard.
He's an interesting blend of geek and handsome. Like, there are times where he's very dweebish and times where he's very, like, very leading man. And, like, but the push broom mustache, I was just like, wow, is this a visual effect? Like, it's like.
I honestly think they put that mustache in there just because it is so, like, bushy. I think they put that in there because he looks I think he would have been a little too, like, dashing and handsome with the beard. So I think the push broom cut just makes him look, like a little fusty.
There's a sequence later in the series too, which we'll explore in the spoiler portion, where you don't want to, I think it helps mask his expression a little bit too. Right?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So so I think that helps. I don't mean to do
that. Then we have Tanaya Miller, who was playing Mrs. Gross, the housekeeper. Classic spooky manor role, a definite twist on it, but there's always a housekeeper, right, named Mrs. Something. So,
and this character is taken directly from The Turn of the Screw. Mrs. Right. Gross was a full-on character in that, although she gets a lot more dimension in this series. And Tanaya Miller, man, I think gives the best performance on this whole series. Yeah. We can talk more about her later.
And then Amelia Eve is sort of the last main cast member who plays the gardener, Jamie, I think. And so, yeah, so that's our household staff jammed up in a spooky house with a spooky, like, duck pond in the front of it. And two kids who might be lovely and might be spooky. We don't know. So that's the setting for the haunting of Bly Manor. There's also like some fun, spooky, long family history tied up in the house. And, like,
we should mention, I think there's one left that we mentioned Oliver Jackson Cohen as Peter Quint.
Yes.
Who's like, I think he was kind of like a assistant to Henry Thomas and his brother.
Correct.
But then there's the previous governess,
right.
Tahira Sharif. Her name was the character's name is Miss Jessel, who died. That's all we really know as Danny Clayton, the new governess, arrives at the house, is that she died, and it was tragic.
So this is a I'll just say my like vague spoiler-free impressions, just so folks can see like whether or not they think this is something they want to do. Haunting of Hill House was like an A+ series for me. I went back and rewatched it like immediately after I finished it. Something I've said many times since, and I definitely said at the time, is that it felt less like a horror show and more like a family, an adult family drama. There's like a kind of famous episode in the middle of Haunting of Hill House that takes place ostensibly all in one shot, sort of like in a funeral parlor. That's just very like family drama, like could be an episode of Parenthood, because it's about a family sort of fighting with each other while spooky stuff happens around them. And and so all of that just made me love that show so much. This is a shaggier, I would say, version of that. You don't have the cohesion of everyone is part of a family and have a shared history together to sort of act as a spine of this show. These are various characters who are coming towards each other, centering on Bly Manor. You do have a love story. There's a love story at the center of this. So that's sort of the like emotional core of it, in the end. But, it just feels a little less like well put together in that way. The performances are still fantastic. The production value is incredible. Looks gorgeous. I found myself without that like stronger cohesive element to it. I found myself feeling that like Netflix drag of, there could have been fewer episodes to make this a tighter, spookier tale. So that's sort of my vague take on it. What did you think, Anthony?
I hear what you're saying. I hate to be contrary, but I kind of like that it wasn't that same structure, like not just that it would be a family story, but I like that the stories are a little more loosely connected. It's kind of like one of those pots on your front porch that have like a different, like it's one big ceramic thing, but it's got little spots for different succulents to grow in. Like the stories really are separate in some ways. Mrs. Gross's story, the uncle played by Henry Thomas, his story is like they kind of get their own standalone pieces, but they branch off of this main narrative. And what I liked about that was it felt a little fresher to me as I moved along. It didn't drag for me at all. Like I think there are weaker and stronger parts of the series. But in general, I was like sad when it ended. I wanted some more, and I would have been down for a little more, even a little more exploration of the ghosts, which I think we could get to in a second. But, the ghosts in Hill House were unnamed. They were just disturbing, creepy presences, often layered into the background, and there's a neat psychological phenomenon where you're watching the action and you're unaware of what's just sort of standing in open space. They're not
right.
We call them hidden ghosts, but the interesting thing is they're not hidden at all. Like, they're just there.
Oh, once you know they're there, you're like, you know, oh, they're my there. God. Yeah.
But a lot of times, you know, you miss them unless you're watching for them. And I think what this story does, instead of telling the story of people who are very closely entwined, a family who are reckoning with serious things that have happened to all of them, you have in this story a group of characters who've come together who each have their own orbits, right? But they, they're pinballing off of each other. They're caught in, and this is a loaded phrase, they're caught in each other's gravity. And I like that they were a little bit individualistic, that they were not necessarily, it's not all one cohesive story. It's probably four or five different stories all orbiting each other, but intersecting. So I liked that. It felt like I got the same vibe from Haunting of Hill House, the same scares and the same entertainment value, but a different kind of story, which is what you want from a sequel or, you know, a second installment, what have you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in that I wouldn't have wanted like a carbon copy of Haunting of Hill House. Mm-hmm. But what is interesting, Haunting of Hill House does at least have that really familiar, especially to me because I'm obsessively rewatching Lost for another project. Mm-hmm. But it's that Lost inspired structure of, like, you know, an episode pegged to a character, right? So the blank episode. And Haunting of Bly Manor has a few of those, right? I could safely say there's the Mrs. Gross episode, there's the Henry Thomas episode, you know, stuff like that. But it's not quite as clean as that, the mm-hmm. way that Haunting of Hill House was. So
what's interesting is they're more entwined at the beginning, and then as you move along, it's like you have the Henry Thomas episode, you have the Tanya Miller episode, and then another, I think let's call it the black and white episode.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting to me. And I guess something that it does capture about Turn of the Screw, and for this I want to give it credit, is a sense of frustration. And you might think that that's a negative, but I don't think it is. Because I think with Turn of the Screw and stories like it, you're frustrated that you don't know everything. You're frustrated that you don't know more. You're frustrated that your characters aren't just like getting in the car and leaving. You're frustrated. It's that good frustration. It's a tension, and it's just sort of like and things just feel like sort of impenetrable in certain ways. People are behaving oddly. What's up with this housekeeper? What's up with these children? What's going on? Why can't I get straight answers, sort of thing? So, you know, Victoria Pedretti, who I thought was... I mean, Victoria Pedretti in Haunting of Hill House, and also she was fantastic in season two of You. She's the part of Haunting of Hill House that really, really, really sticks with me. She, like, her episode of Haunting of Hill House just made me openly weep. And so putting her at the center of this is a smart move. She's more centralized in this story. As an audience surrogate for the frustratingly spooky things that are going on, you know?
Yeah. Her Nell in Hill House was a lost person. Like, she was doomed, and she played it with such heaviness, such grief. Just thinking about it chokes me up. Right? And it sounds silly to say about like a ghost movie, but that, to me, that is the heart that Mike Flanagan captured with that story, is that it's this spooky ghost story, a Halloween story, and yet I think you felt a little more deeply for all of those characters than you do for these ones. That was family. These are coworkers, so you care about them, but you just don't know them as well. And I think what's interesting is, so Nell was just this haunt, you know, I hate to use this word, but like a haunted person. She was, she was in the shadows, and her Danny Clayton in Bly Manor is so sunny and chipper. She reminds me of the babysitter from, and I mean this as a compliment, in The Incredibles, you know, who's like, my Jack-Jack is just, he's just full of energy over here. And don't worry, Mrs. Incredible, I'm going to take good care of it. Like, she's so upbeat. And she has
that
this
1980s Midwestern vibe thing.
Like,
yeah.
And she's older, but she seems like a teenager. Like, she's in some ways, I think she's very repressed, and we can get into that in the spoiler portion. She does seem like, you know, sometimes you meet like, she's younger than this, but like you meet like a middle-aged lady, a school teacher or something who spends a lot of time around children. And then like even around adults, kind of talks to adults like they're children.
Sure.
She has that vibe about her. And, you know, it completely changes her look. This sort of sunny, puffy 80s blonde hair. Very American in a very
laced up British world.
Yeah, very pastoral British environment. I like the performance, and I think it gives her a place to go. Is that she is so cheerful? She almost seems like somebody from an 80s comedy, but she's in an 80s horror story.
Yeah,
and I thought she did a very good job.
So let's go into spoilers in a second, but yeah, I will just sum up and say, Haunting Hill House is A+ for me. This, I'm afraid, is like a bit more like a B+ for me, but it's still, I would still recommend it. I just think that it's not quite the like. Plus, the Haunting Hill House had the advantage of taking me completely off guard, because like I had heard some good things about Mike Flanagan, but I had only ever seen Oculus, so I did not expect what I got from Haunting of Hill House. I was really, really pleasantly surprised. And so then you come into this one with like the Haunting of Hill House expectations, and it's like, oh well, it's not quite there for me, but still a spooky ride. So there you go.
And as we venture into spoiler land, I think this is something I was hinting at before about when we talk about the hidden ghosts. Is in Hill House, the hidden ghosts, they were there for atmosphere. You never got an explanation of who they were. You got a little explanation about some of the things that had happened in Hill House and who some of the more pronounced presences were. But in Bly Manor, the ghosts that appear are very specific, and they all have, to one degree or another, their own origin story that comes out as the series progresses. So next, shall we venture into spoiler territory? If you haven't
watched the rest...
Press pause and rejoin.
Buyer
us.
Beware. Here come the spooky spoilers.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right. So let's talk about two highlight episodes for us. We've talked about this a little bit before off mic, so I think I remember that we agree on this. So let's start with the Tanaya Miller, Mrs. Gross episode, which I think is the strongest episode, though we can make a case maybe for another one. But this is a pretty high concept, looping through time. As you mentioned, Raul Coley's mustache plays a good role in this episode to keep him sort of impenetrable. You and I both kind of clocked that there might be something going on with Mrs. Gross early on because she wouldn't eat. And you and I are both like, oh, ghost for sure. Already dead. And we were right. But I was like, I wound up doubting myself a little bit because I was like, oh, that lady is definitely already dead. And then like something happened, like, cause she can still like move things. So I was like, okay, she can touch things and hold things. So maybe what are the ghost rules here?
What's interesting about this is he sets up very specific ghost rules. Mm-hmm. And, that wasn't the case in Hill House. There wasn't as precise a logic to how the ghosts operated. But in Bly Manor, the rules are you die at Bly Manor, and your spirit stays at Bly Manor. And you're basically able to manifest yourself as another person for a time. And the more time that passes, the more you begin to fade even from yourself, even though you still exist there. And that allows for two things. One, it leads to these ghosts who are older, who have like these almost erased faces, you know, the faces that begin to disappear. That's a spooky image. But I think, Joanna, like one of the things that really worked for me about Bly Manor was that idea of the spirit disappearing, because I think anybody who's lost somebody that they love in their life, as time goes on, you know, when you first lose them, you just think, how will I continue without this person? I just can't imagine life without them. And then you get 10, 20, 30 years away, and the sad thing is you start to forget what their voice sounded like, and you start to forget what life was like with them. And it's not that you're trying to lose them. It's just, it diminishes, it dims. And as time goes on, that's what happens. And I think that's a very real thing that's sort of layered in, an emotional, realistic, heartfelt thing that's layered in among this like Halloween-y spooky story.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And it gives our, you know, we've got our two, well, I would say one villainous ghost, and also Mrs. Jessel is there, but the a strong motivation that is at least somewhat sympathetic. Mm-hmm. Like the reason they're motivated by this desire to not fade away to nothingness, and they will if they stay at Bly, right? So they're trying to become passengers in other bodies in order to get out of there. Now, unfortunately, the targets that they've marked here are children, and that is something we can't be sympathetic towards. What is interesting to me, I will say that I think that Bly goes a little too far in trying to create sympathy for everyone. I'm usually down with that. I usually let's make our villains nuanced. That's something I usually really respond to. But in Bly, the malicious presence of this former assistant
Peter Quinn,
yeah, like he to me, like just the full name, like Peter Quinn, like that to me strikes fear as this almost like malevolent, primordial, like hypersexual evil that like runs through Turn of the Screw. That's just like my takeaway from Turn of the Screw. And so then to like try to make him like this sympathetic young man who has this horrible family, and you know we're meant to feel for him, I'm like, that's a facet I could have done without. You could have flattened that character a little bit more, and it would have worked for me. I don't know. What do you think?
I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think it was just about creating a bit of degree on him, and versus the character played by Kate Siegel. I'm blanking on her name, but she's the big bad of the series.
Right.
Remember, we're in spoiler territory, people, so no complaints. I think it was just meant to put a little daylight between him and her. But I think another real thing that's embedded in Bly Manor is the corrupting influence of toxic personalities. And you have that in families, too, but you have it in workplaces. Hell, we have it in politics. And, you know, we don't have to go there necessarily. But it's, you know, Miss Jessel is a very sweet and in some ways innocent,
right,
perhaps naive character, and she's corrupted by Peter Quinn. She's seduced by him in several ways, in all the ways. She's, I think she's kind of impressed by how cool and confident he is. And he strikes me as a grifter. Like, he's moved in on these brothers, these two business partners, and he's climbing his way up the ladder. And he just seems like, you know, he's the evil assistant who's going to someday stick a knife in your back, you know? Right. And he, you know, Miss Jessel's very beautiful, so he obviously falls for her. But what's funny is we talked about the kids who they taking possession of, sometimes feeling like real children, and then other times they have this weird adult quality about them. Yeah. Peter Quint has that as a grown man. Like, there are times he's very charming and suave, and you can see why she fell for him. And other times he has that bad boyfriend vibe of, like, really immature and needy and clingy and angry and tantrum throwing. And that's that's before we find out just what a rotten cheat he is. Like, he's a bad dude. Yet, I don't think he has had the time to develop into the full-on toxic narcissist that he would eventually become, because he is offed by this lady of the lake who really is the, you know, from centuries past, is just sort of laps him in narcissism. You know, she is, I think, just, he's the JV team. She's the varsity of,
she's the MVP
of self-pity and self-delusion and and selfishness. Every self that you could attach, she comes to embody. And he's like working his way. He's the assistant. He goes from being the assistant to the brothers to kind of being like the apprentice to her. So, you know, I didn't mind that he had a little bit of sympathy about him. You know, I think it just helped differentiate the different levels that he was on versus the Lady of the Lake.
I have to say, like, I agree with your assessment of, like, this narcissistic personality attached to this Lady of the Lake. I just, as an origin story, you know, the black and white episode that you alluded to is the origin story for this, terrorizing ghost. And I don't know. It's interesting to me because, like, jealousy between two sisters over a man feels like a weird, weak origin story. And then, like, and then the fact that she's on this, like, programmed loop that doesn't really seem to have any, like, you know, she'll drown a Peter Quint. She'll drown Danny as well. Like, she doesn't, she's not a discerning ghost. And that, I don't know, that, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, what's her motivation, and then she just doesn't have one. She's just like a clockwork on a track.
Well,
at this point,
that goes back to the other thing about how even to themselves, the ghosts fade away, is that they don't really remember who they are or what they are. They just become more like patterns. The longer they've been there.
But in that way, then, like, that's less spooky to me than a ghost with a personality or intention. You know what I mean?
It is. That's the trade-off, I think, is that she was once. And I would argue there's a little more to it than, like, jealousy over a man. She's very sickly, her character, as a human when she's alive. And I think there's, like, resentment at being ill, at being separated from her family, because at not being able to fully participate in life. Like, there's a bitterness to her that I think also humanizes her, that you can see why this cascade of bad luck would begin to warp your personality and really make you resentful, really make you indifferent to people, you know? And this is based on not the turn of the screw, but from another Henry James short story called The Romance of Certain Old Clothes, which involves, like, two sisters and a box of dresses that belong to the one that didn't live.
Right. But that's like, and it's like it's a short story, you know, it's like a short, twisty ghost story. And like, yes, they only dedicate one episode to it. But I just think that that episode doesn't quite get there for not just her motivations, but the sister's motivations. Like, you could see why the sister, you know, always the submissive sister to her more dominant sister's personality, having, you know, the wear and tear caring for someone who is chronically ill can take on you. Like, all of that stuff is there and understandable. But there's just something that weird that happens with the sister that doesn't quite track with, like, her established personality. I don't know, that whole episode, I wanted to really love it, because I do usually like, you know, I like, there's a weird later season episode of Lost that is sort of, like, famously disliked because they just like zoom way back in time and you're like, what's happening? And a lot of people don't like it. But I like when shows do something, take a weird wide swing like that. And so I really wanted to like this like weird black and white, let's do a short story and it's going to be the origin story of Our Lady of the Lake sort of thing vibe. But it just didn't work for me and I wanted it to.
Well, I think, yeah, I agree that it doesn't quite get there. It falls a little short. It's still enjoyable. Honestly speaking, I still got a kick out of it. But it did feel like, I do think the ghosts, they become artifacts in the story. And the minute you begin answering them and exploring them, they disintegrate a little bit, you know? So once the more understanding we have about this Lady in the Lake, okay, now we have a full understanding of the rules, is that her misery was so intense that it became like a weight on this home. And that weight has its own magnetic field in a way, so that your own spirit can't go. It attaches to the, let's say, to stretch the metaphor a little, the iron in whatever grieves you, right? Whatever regret you have. So if you're Mrs. Gross and you regret that you've forever stifled your own ambitions by clinging to what's safe and what's known, that's the thing that helps attach you to this home. And, you know, there are various other figures who have, you know, less well-explored storylines, but that all of them are being held at this place by the presence of the Lady in the Lake. And, you know, I think it's worth noting that Danny Clayton, Victoria Pedretti's governess character, she shows up at Bly Manor already haunted.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to delve into that at all.
Yeah, she feels sorry, it's an evocative ghost. The like flashing glasses ghost.
She sees him in mirrors. He doesn't necessarily appear to her outside of that. But she sees him reflected in cars and storefronts.
I think it's just like, I'm sorry to say this, but I think when we got to the moment where he does die, it felt like a little, the guilt she carries feels good and real, not good, but like it feels very well laid and understandable to me. The fact that the guilt is tied to her own sexuality and the fact that, you know, she felt like she couldn't express who she was in the 80s in the Midwest and felt like she let down this boy who was her dear friend her whole life, but whom she didn't love. And there is an element, you know, just in that there is that element of toxicity with Peter Quinn. There is a bit of an element of toxicity this guy too. He's got that nice guy possessiveness sort of her and not reading the room in any sort of way. But I just like the manner of his death was just sort of like, I don't know, just like a little silly in a way that like felt like it undercut the effectiveness that ghost had so far.
Yes, I agree. It's a little extreme. And then it becomes...
Yeah.
Okay, like it's a little over the top, the way he dies. I don't think that was the right choice to make for how... I think having him die might have been appropriate or necessary for the story. So I guess we can say the thing that's vexing her is that she's gay. She's a lesbian. She's attracted to women. It's the 80s. Again, talk about like things fading away. I like think back to the 80s. It was not okay to be out. It just was not. Right. You were a criminal at worst or disgusting at best to so many people, to the culture. Like it was a hateful time and that was normalized. And so I do think that's one of the things, like looking at it through the 2020 lens, it's going to be hard for some people who weren't alive then or were kids then to remember like just how intense that compulsion to remain in the closet was, just the fear associated with it. So what I find interesting about her relationship with this boy is they were very close friends. We see them as little kids, like best pals, you know, and yet he does not know this about her. right? Even they're not close enough that she could even trust him with her deepest feelings, you know, to say, this is who I am, this is who I feel. And he's fallen in love with her. What's not to love? She's beautiful, she's fun. You can understand why he is attracted to her as a straight guy. And yet he's not listening to her. He's not picking up.
Not seeing
he's
her.
Not picking up on her cues. And when he does pick up on her tearfulness that maybe marrying him is not what she wants, he reacts angrily. And in a way, I understand even the anger. He's not abusive.
Yeah.
He's not abusive. He's hurt. And he lashes out. Yeah. You know, I don't know what means of offing him would have been appropriate. I don't know that suicide or something would have been, you know, any better. Like, maybe he was so embarrassed, you know, that it severed the last thread of his, like, self-respect or whatever, that she doesn't want me. Maybe he has some bigotry in him, too. Like, had he taken his own life or something? I don't know that would have worked either. That might have been too dramatic, even for this gothic romance. But another kind of accidental death, I think, would have just been less jarring, and still would have allowed her to carry the regret that maybe she led him to this. You know, maybe it would have, even if it had just been a car accident, she finds out he left angrily and died in a car accident. But, like, stepping out of the car and getting creamed by a truck, like, it just has that Meet Joe Black vibe about it.
Like the end of Mean Girls sort of vibe to it. I don't know. It felt like almost a comedy moment in what should have just been straight tragedy.
I think the cliche mixed. Of Mack truck from stage left just has to go. Right, like that.
Let's get rid of it.
But, like, you know, like, but had he died in a car accident, and she gets word that night after their big argument, you could legitimately go, was he driving erratically because he was upset? Did he do this on purpose to hurt himself or to hurt me? Like, and those unanswered questions, I think, would have justified seeing him everywhere. You know,
right? You could easily be haunted by that. So. So that's, you know, that's the thing that only worked a little bit for me. I do want to get back to the Tanya Miller episode, just quickly. This season of Bly Manor has a lot of loops. There's a lot of looping motifs, right? And this is sort of the epitome of that, where we see Mrs. Gross is sort of stuck on a track, revisiting something, trying to get to the truth of something, which is that she's already dead. And I guess my point in saying earlier that, like, you and I had sort of clocked this early is not to be like, oh, how clever are we, but more like, it doesn't matter. Like, and that's to me the mark of a really, really well executed storyline on television, is when you know the twist or the conclusion or the reveal already, and it's still an incredibly compelling and engrossing hour of television. Mm-hmm. A lot of TV shows these days, I think, rely on that surprise, the jolt of surprise alone being the thing that hurts you or emotionally impacts you. And, you know, we... We say this on one of my other podcasts. We talk about how it's about the execution. Mm-hmm. And this is executed so well. This, like, sort of tender, low-key love story between Raoul Coley's character and Tanya Miller's character. You know, you love these people and you want them to be together. She's got her own tragic, was stuck in, like, a bad... Like, it feels stuck on at Bly Manor in a way that's not just literally tied to her ghostliness, right? And Raoul Coley's character, the cook, is also sort of stuck there taking care of his, like, sick mother, and they have this opportunity. Like, they could go. They could go to Paris. Go! You want them to go, but it's too late. She's already dead and she can't go. And that's just, like, devastating.
I agree. And I like that the show is willing to give us characters who don't have a trauma that's in capital letters, right? Like,
right.
Dead fiance, or, you know, what's afflicting them is much more of a, like, they're both like George Bailey type characters from It's a Wonderful Life. Like, They both feel this yearning to go further and have ambition, but they feel obligation as well to stay close to home. And sometimes that obligation becomes an excuse for you to not do the thing that you're nervous about, even if it excites
right.
you. And yeah. I like that that's a low-key, again, a real thing that's layered into the show, where I could relate to Mrs. Gross, you know? And and her plight seemed real and believable. And the moment where we begin to realize that she is on a loop, just as the lady in the lake is on a loop, that she's reliving things from the past because she has been murdered and is a ghost. The tragedy of that is it's already too late. It is too late for her.
Yeah.
And she, and I think that's a thing we don't often get in, especially Hollywood storytelling, which is in Hollywood storytelling, it's never too late, right? You can still make a change.
Right.
And in this, and in right. her case, it is literally too late. Like she didn't act when she had the chance, and now it's over, and all she can do is relive it. And she's such a ruminative character, so reflective on that. And you can tell it, you know, again, it's a real thing that haunts her. It's not some violent extreme episode.
Yeah, it's just a beautiful episode, and the challenges of telling an episode of a character unstuck from time. I mentioned this to you when we chatted immediately after watching all the episodes about how much this reminded me of the Sissy Spacek episode of Castle Rock, which Castle Rock is a mixed bag, but that episode is widely considered to be very good, and Sissy Spacek's character is also sort of unstuck in time. And that's really hard to pull off in a coherent way. And I think this episode actually does it even more successfully than that episode of Castle Rock did, even though I really liked that episode of Castle Rock. Mm-hmm. There's something, you know, the vagueness and how it helps explain her vagueness earlier in the season. And then there's just something about the performance. It's beautiful. It's heartbreaking. She's so good at switching back and forth between being like bright and on top of the ball and really like effective and efficient, and then confused and vague and foggy, which is like the thing that she's ping-ponging through in this experience.
And so, her devotion to the actual house, like the house itself is a vessel. It's not like a malevolent house. The wood and the blaster right. is not evil, but her pride in it is it's sweet. It's also misguided. And I think anybody who has put their job before other things in their life that matter can relate to that as well. She talks about like, this is where I'm from. Like, I don't live right. here. I'm an employee of Bly Manor, but she's very proud of her work, you know? And I think that's nice too, is it's not total drudgery for her. She likes being there. She likes the home. She probably wishes she could live in a nice home like that. And in fact, she does live there. So,
yeah, there's a moment in one of her sort of like hops through time where she's talking to, you know, the late lady of the house, and she's, you know, the kid's dead mom, and she's comforting her, Mrs. Gross, and she's like, you can just stay here forever. And I'm like, oh no, she's going to stay there forever. No. Yeah, her loyalty to this family, which I think can be sourced back to that relationship she had with the dead mom, and also there's something, you know, something that's definitely not in Turn of the Screw necessarily, something sort of feminist in her defiance of Peter Quinn and like her yes. defense of Miss Jessel and like all that sort of stuff, like that she is the only one sort of fighting the fight here for a while, and I really love that for her.
She so, is yeah. yeah she is very,
because I feel like it I didn't reread Turn of the Screw, but I feel like in many versions of this story a Mrs. Gross would just be judgmental of a Miss Jessel, right? And just mm-hmm. be like, well, you know, she made mistakes, or she was loose or foolish girl or whatever it is. But there's just a tremendous amount of sympathy and a correct identification of Peter as the sort of malevolent actor here.
Yeah.
That she's onto his bullshit way before anyone else is. So, yeah. All right. And let's talk about the last sort of very we'll talk about the finale really quickly, but let's talk about the Henry Thomas episode, which is another loop sort of motif where you've got, and based on another Henry James story, where you've got a man consumed by his own grief and trapped with this grinning, creepy, you know, worst case scenario version of himself. In his own office.
Yes. So this is based on a short story called The Jolly Corner about a man who revisits, believe it was his childhood home, and he encounters a doppelganger, a version of himself that has this creepy, sneering leer. And what Flanagan did and his team of writers did with this episode was give that story to the uncle character, the Henry Thomas character, who doesn't want anything to do with the kids. He wants to pay to have them taken care of and never go to Bly Manor. And they've created this story where he was having an affair with his brother's wife and maybe the father of the daughter. there's no maybe about it, actually, by the time this episode ends. But he is, after their deaths, after his brother dies and his sister-in-law and lover dies, he feels, I mean, I don't know if regret is the right word. He feels guilt. He feels agony at the way he behaved, even though he's torn between actually caring about this woman and knowing it was wrong to have this relationship with his sister-in-law. He's reckoning with his misdeeds. And I think they found a way that really doesn't have anything to do with Bly Manor, excuse me, to manifest that in a spectral way, a scary, spooky way, by having him face this version of himself. The little devil on his shoulder that tells him, don't worry about it, go for it, do what you want, comes to life.
Right.
And it's not a little devil, it's him. This is who I am. I did these things. And he is wrestling with that. I liked it. I thought Henry Thomas gave a great pair of performances in this. What'd you think?
Yes, I loved it. And like, I liked Henry Thomas in Haunting of Hill House as well. Mm-hmm. I thought he was fantastic in that. And that's, just like Ryan Murphy does with his stable of actors. You and I were talking about, like, I think you said this, I don't want to steal it from you, but you were like, where would Henry Thomas be? Not for Mike Flanagan right now. Like Henry Thomas, you know, he cropped up on an episode of what is it called? Better Things, right? You know, he's been around, like, doing things here and there, but like not central to a story in a while. And this is just like a nice meaty material for him to work with and to show us what he can do. And like, I got some questions about some of the accent work from some of the actors in this series as a whole, and I'm not sure Henry Thomas completely nails the British accent. But in terms of like the playing two distinct characters who look identical, acting opposite yourself, all that sort of stuff, oh, it's good. It's so good. And like, I don't have an office that I can go to and like Don Draper myself into like a whiskey nap and stuff like that, but that just feels like really, you know, he just like, he lives in his office now. There was a second where I thought he might be a ghost too, because I was like, does this man, is he haunting his own office? Like, he can't leave or whatever. It's just, I think, a very effective hour of television.
Yeah, very much so. And look, I think he'd still be around. He's a character actor, right? He would be doing various supporting parts. I think Mike Flanagan just has given him, he always gives him something juicy to do. Yes. And also something different, like, he's not a bad actor. In the Ouija movie that Flanagan made, he plays a priest. And, you know, this a quality about Henry Thomas, it's his face. And you see this often with former child stars, where a child is cast in something because they have an almost cartoonish face. Big eyes, a big mouth. You know, Ron Howard and Clint Howard are good examples of this. They had very cute, Kewpie doll-looking faces. And Henry Thomas was a very cute kid, you know, very sweet. Obviously, like, Elliot is indelible in the memory. And yet, as an adult, he still has that childlike face. It's just now on a middle-aged man, right? So he's very handsome, but he's able to do things with that face. He has a very malleable face. So in some of Mike's other movies and shows, he can play sinister, he can play sweet, He can play somewhere in between. He can play Lost. Like, he can play a lot of different things, and he puts all those faces to good use in this episode. So, you know, high five to Henry Thomas.
So lastly, I want to talk about this, the finale, which is, I think you and I had discussed, I don't think we can say this for certain, but I can say the impression that I got is that they had a whole extra episode of material. You know, as much as I was like, I don't want more, it also felt like a lot is jammed into that final episode. And we've got this extremely long coda after, like, things are resolved at Bly Manor. We've got our you know, lovers, our young women who are in love, trying to start a life together, and unfortunately Dany is still haunted, knows that there's like a ticking clock on her and is still haunted, and so we see them sort of in quasi-montage try to build a life together and know that that is doomed ultimately, and eventually is doomed. They don't find a way out of it. And there's also, we should mention, a frame narrative that you know, this is where Carla Gugino comes in, that started the episode and ends the episode, of a wedding, where every member of this family has developed an amnesia around this event.
When you leave Bly Manor, what happened at Bly Manor goes away. You
can't stays at Bly Manor.
It's like Vegas. But also, this is the Carla Gugino character. That narrator is, I think it was a male in the novel, but like
in the book.
Like a man at a party relates this story. So that framework was.
Yeah, the frame narrative is absolutely.
And we find out that she was the gardener, so she's now, you know, a little bit older. They put some gray streaks in Carla Gugino's hair, and so take it away.
well, for as much as I love, like, some of the core of Bly Manor, this is where a lot of it falls apart for me. And this, so there's something, I think this love story is quite beautiful. I think, I feel the emotion. I just feel like they're reaching for a metaphor of some kind with this haunting for Dany. And is it like, is it mental health? Like, what is it exactly? I don't think that they nail whatever metaphor they're reaching for. And then I also find the closing wedding chapter to be, Carla Gugino is great always. And so the poignancy of her looking in water reflections for her lost lover, that is, you know, that gets me. I'm not a stone-hearted person. That gets to me. But like, it just all feels like a little like weird and slapdash in the end. And that's too bad, because I think that there is groundwork that they laid there, you know?
I do feel like they don't quite finish the knot, right? Like, that it doesn't tie up neatly. From all these other examples I've given of like, oh, this feels like a metaphor for this aspect of real life. Yeah, I don't quite get what they're going for. I think if I were to strain to understand it, I think, well, first, what happens is they resolve things at Bly Manor because the lady in the lake is drowning Flora. And we've established that the ghosts can possess the children, right? And what Dany does to save Flora from this juggernaut of a ghost is offer her own self, right? Take me, you can inhabit me. And the lady in the lake disappears. Presumably into Dany. But Dany is still Dany, right? So I think you're right. Like, it does feel like there's something a little disjointed about this finale. Was there to be a question of whether Dany was really Dany or whether she was this other spirit now trying to figure out how she fits into the world? It almost becomes a separate story then. About these two women, the gardener and the governess. The governess has, as you said, maybe it's like a mental health issue. There's something tragic about her, something that can't be fixed. And she ends up feeling this way too and takes her own life at Bly Manor in the lake. Goes back and just ends it. And so it was very affecting for me, the final shot. But I agree with you that there isn't cohesion to that resolution. Like, I don't fully understand what it means or what we're supposed to take from it.
Right.
What I did get from it was, in all of these stories of people who are haunted by things they've done, by people they've lost, sometimes you can be haunted by that memory of the person you loved or the thing you loved. And that can be a comfort instead of a terror. So it ends with her asleep on the chair, and there's just what's obviously Danny's hand on her shoulder. And yeah. I think
I just got a physical chill when you said that.
And you know, it's not meant to.
Is there a ghost in this podcasting closet? I don't know. Anyway,
and it's not played as terrifying. It's not meant to be like, like, you know, Jason comforting. Freddy jumps out of the mirror or something. It's like, it's meant to be soothing. And I think that's also a true thing that, as I said, we begin to lose the memory of the people we've lost, but sometimes they come back to us in vivid ways, in a dream or in an object that you find that belonged to them, and you remember a certain time together. So I think what he was going for there is, even in the midst of real life loss, that there can be memories when something is over that are happy, that are nice takeaways. And, you know, it all resolves at a wedding, which is a generally happy event. And we see some of the characters from this story that they have, you know, happily ever afters, I guess you could say, is that they have at the very least had ever afters. And that's,
yes, they've moved on from Bly Manor. I would be remiss in not mentioning this. And I don't think that, you know, Flanagan or his team or anyone working on this installment has any sort of, like, you know, anything other than, you know, positive progressive ideas around homosexuality. Like, you know, Danny's anxiety around her homosexuality is treated with, like, nothing but, like, sympathy and all this sort of stuff. Unfortunately, this idea of, like, these two women settle down and open up, like, what, a plant shop together, mm-hmm. et cetera. The way that it has to end tragically sadly feeds into that sort of bury your gaze trope where, like, mm-hmm. you know, a gay couple doesn't get a happily ever after. You can maybe argue that, like, hardly anyone gets a happily ever after in a ghost story, but, like, I just think it's we're recording this before the episodes hit Netflix. I don't know how this is going to land with people. I'm a little worried that the show is going to catch a lot of flack for that, just because, like, gay audiences are so tired of seeing their on-screen love stories ending this way.
They don't all have to be tragic. Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah, they definitely are open to that. They're vulnerable to that criticism. You know, I will say they do get many years of being happy together. It's not...
It seems really nice. I love their apartment. There's plants everywhere. It looks beautiful.
They have a good life, and they have a good life for a while, and then
for a little while
it catches up to them. I mean, several. I think it's many years at least, isn't it? A decade.
Yeah.
More?
Like, yeah. You know, it's years.
But yes, I think you want. I think we're at a point in the culture now where we get the tragedy, and maybe what people are yearning for is hope a little more than the darkness. And I don't know, can you gather that from the hand on the shoulder? Is that a hopeful ending? Is there
maybe but that's know? Like you get a ghost wife. No, it's just I think all things being equal, you know, gay couples and ghost stories and straight couples and ghost stories can all end tragically together, right? But we're not, all things are not equal yet.
Yes.
And so it's just disproportionate in our culture, in our television, our film, that gay romances and almost, like, very specifically lesbian romances end this way. And so, you know, I think that's just too bad. And I just wish I better understood what they were trying to say so that I could better, like, feel like I could justify it or say, I, you know, this makes a lot more sense to me, you know, so.
Absolutely.
But that's Bly Manor, a mixed bag of ghosts, a spooky treat grab bag for your for your October watching pleasure. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you want to make sure we hit?
I think the soundtrack is really good. I love the 80s songs.
The last
little tidbit, this is just a little bit of an Easter egg, is I do like that Mike Flanagan is a filmmaker, a storyteller, who definitely respects his elders. And this story, Turn of the Screw, has been adapted so many times. And I like that he pays homage to the things that come before. You know, I think Mike is very sensitive to ghosts, and so he doesn't want to rattle them. I like that there was a 1961 film called The Innocents, starring Deborah Carr, directed by Jack Clayton, whose last name becomes Danny Clayton's last name in this as a tribute to him. That was a really cool adaptation from a generation or two generations ago. And I like that he honors it and doesn't just try to pave over adaptations of the past. So, you know, it's a good way to maintain good karma in the storytelling ghost verse.
Can we point people to your chat with Mike and stuff that you might have that might be up on the website around Bly Manor?
Yeah, I did a first look of Bly Manor, and if you've watched it already, I still think there's stuff in the story that I put in there that you wouldn't pick up as spoilers if you were reading it for the first time and getting an introduction. But after you watch it, I think there's a little more insight into it and some of the references and the way he talks about the characters. So if you dig the show, if you liked our conversation, I think you can find some of his words, Mike Flanagan, explaining the story as he saw it. So hopefully people will enjoy that.
Excellent. If all things go according to plan, I should have something up on some of the Henry James allusions that we talked about. So that's Anthony and Joanna on Bly Manor. We'll be back with at least one more special episode before the year is over. Anthony, where are we going in our next very special episode of Still Watching?
We are venturing into a galaxy far, far away.
Oh, pew, pew, pew. It's Star Wars. It's back.
Baby.
Mandalorian. So, yeah.
Baby Yoda, the series starring the Mandalorian.
We'll be talking about Baby Yoda and hopefully no ghosts next time on when Anthony
there are ghosts. Star Wars has ghosts. There are ghosts all over the place.
Oh, Force ghosts, of course. Ugh, joy. All right, don't take my nerd card. All right, Anthony Bresnikan, where can folks find you until then?
For now, I'm on Twitter at Bresnikan. I don't know how long that's gonna last,
yeah, so you can find me at Joe Wrote This. We're both on vf.com, you know, doing our best to bring you entertaining news about movies that may or may not ever come out, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe, stay spooky.
Happy Halloween.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.